Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. And among the people that I've had the privilege to become acquainted with, to get to know, to work with, and to admire, there are few who hold a candle to our guest in this first segment. She is Deborah Burlingame, an absolutely splendid person, a great patriot, a woman who has distinguished herself in a number of different capacities, but really been thrust involuntarily into the midst of this war for the free world by the murder of her brother, Chick Burlingame, who was the pilot of American Airlines Flight 77, which, after it was hijacked by jihadists on 9/11, was flown into the Pentagon with murderous effect. Deborah has gone on since that terrible day to become a fixture in the national security debate by virtue of being one of the leaders of the 9/11 families. In fact, she was a founder of 9/11 Families for a Safe and Strong America. She's also served with great distinction on the board of the 9/11 Memorial Foundation and Museum. It is always a delight to have a chance to talk with her, especially as we approach the anniversary of that terrible day 13 years ago. I'm so grateful to you for being with us, Deborah. God bless you, and welcome back.
It's always good to be talking to you, Frank.
You have a unique perspective, it seems to me, on the events of the past 13 years, and I'd like you to share with us your thoughts after all this time about the lessons learned and unlearned from 9/11.
Well, I look today at what's happening, and I can see that so many of the lessons learned have been unlearned. I remember that when the 9/11 Commission was came out in 2004, one of the things that resonated with 9/11 families is that if you wait for a threat to be fully materialized, it may be too late. Another phrase is that 9/11 was a failure of imagination. The 9/11 Commission wasn't a panacea. It didn't do everything. In fact, it wrapped up before it even mentioned, you know, Iran. And before we even knew a great deal about Iran's involvement in 9/11. But by 2004, we knew that it was very important that our economy be strong, that we immigration was a big part of terrorism, and having a weak borders. The 1993 bombers came in through the agricultural jobs program. Two of them did. We couldn't, you know, we need to have a strong military. It can't be degraded the way Clinton had done as a part of the so-called peace dividends. All of these things.
Having to have good identification, you and I first met in connection with the efforts you were making at the time to implement the 9/11 Commission recommendations about secure driver's licenses.
Exactly so. And here we have a president who's poised to open up the gates and let everyone in and give them a legal status of some kind.
And not least, it seems to me, Deborah, we're perilously close to adopting anew, if we haven't already, the pre-9/11 paradigm that these things are all just law enforcement matters and we need to prosecute people. You're an attorney yourself. You know the limitations of our system when it comes to, you know, finding, let alone building a case against and prosecuting these kinds of jihadists.
But I noticed that I didn't hear any of the pundits saying after Obama's now infamous golf course speech about the beheading of Jim Foley, he said that we are determined to bring the perpetrators to justice. We will capture them and bring them to justice. That is a reactive paradigm. That's what Andy McCarthy has talked about for years, that you will not bring the enemy into submission with indictments. that he's bringing us back into this, the criminal paradigm, away from the war paradigm. And when he talks about, in his first press conference, about ISIS, the one he got into so much trouble for, when he talked about managing the problem, it was very reminiscent of Kerry, John Kerry, when he was running for president, saying that he wanted to make terrorism a nuisance, like prostitution, something that you'll never really get rid of, but you have to sort of bat back from time to time. And this is magical thinking, that you could look, it's a failure to look at the enemy with your eyes wide open.
Yeah, I'm talking about failures of imagination. It's a failure to even perceive reality, which could not be more in front of us. And which brings me to the next question. Again, our guest is Deborah Burlingame, a member of the board of the 9/11 Memorial Foundation and one of the leaders of 9/11 Families for a Safe and Strong America. Do you believe, Deborah, that we have, as a government, and I don't mean this as a partisan critique, because I think personally that the Bush administration was guilty of it as well, that we have failed to understand the ideological underpinnings of those who are waging this global jihad against us? And what are the implications of persisting in that failure?
I think we absolutely have failed there's almost a fear of doing so, because anyone who stands up and dares to say the emperor has no clothes, who dares to say that we have been infiltrated by the Muslim Brotherhood to the highest reaches of government, is vilified. And it's almost like a psychosis that we not only must not identify this enemy, we can't even discuss it, we can't even have a debate about it.
But you know what's so striking to me about that, Deborah, is that is the absolutely not only predictable but transparent purpose of these Muslim Brotherhood operatives and other jihadists, is to ensure that we can't talk about these things, that we can't, you know, warn each other about what's developing. This is the absolute essence of their sort of civilization jihad.
Yes, they're very canny about that. And we had I remember I went to an event with Steve Emerson of the Investigative Project, where he had an ex-Muslim Brotherhood person on the panel who said, you know, the whole term Islamophobe that came up in a meeting, a Muslim Brotherhood meeting, where they decided that, you know, the gay community had been so successful with homophobe, let's use that tactic. And I think they've been very successful with it. And look, CARE came after me, after I was vocal about this. And where after they saw that, hey, here's that 9/11 family member, she's on the board of the museum, and let's take her out. They actually were engaged in a campaign to get me kicked off the board, because they understand the potency of having millions of people hear the term Islamist and Salafist and Wahhabi, all those terms you can see in the museum, and they don't want people being awakened.
Talk a little bit about that, Deborah, and we don't have a lot of time, but this is such an important insight into what we're up against. The effort to strip the memorial to 9/11 of this kind of content.
Yes, and to say that it's racist and biased. Look at the whole concept that Muslims are being targeted in the Western world for bias crimes, hate crimes is, you know, the horrible term that's used. That is an illusion, and they've been very successful, even though we know, you know, your Center for Security Policy did a study that Jews are 8 times more likely to be the victims of hate crimes, probably even worse now since that study was done with what's going on in Israel. But yes, they've been very, very successful at using this cultural relativism and multiculturalism as a weapon against us and our own. They've been doing this for years, since before 9/11, using our own values against us to weaken us. And that's why you have, in the middle of this ISIS thing, you have Dianne Feinstein gearing up to attack the CIA again over the rendition and interrogation program.
This is our self-destructive qualities, which they're perfectly capable of exploiting. In fact, I would argue are fomenting wherever they can, notably with respect to trying to force us to conform to Sharia blasphemy laws by making any kind of conversations, including this one, into some sort of racist outrage.
Right. And Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, saying that, yes, well, we don't want to violate the First Amendment, but we can shame people.
Shame and use peer pressure. Old-fashioned techniques. You're exactly right. She was an agent of this effort to subvert, I believe, our First Amendment freedoms. There's so much more to talk about. Deborah, please come back to us again very soon. And in the meantime, I hope that this week of remembrance is one that you will help all of us think hard about the lessons that must be learned and must be practiced in the future. We talk next with A.B. Stoddard about applying some of those lessons to ISIS and the global jihad straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there, America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined for the first time, I believe, by A.B. Stoddard, a woman who has been contributing mightily to the public policy debate and specifically, I think, shedding great light very thoughtfully from her position as associate editor and columnist at The Hill on national security matters. And she has appeared in all of the right places, print and media, and we're just delighted to have her appearing with us here at Secure Freedom Radio. A.B., welcome. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
I hardly know where to begin. It is a target-rich environment, but let's start perhaps with your thoughts on what is going on with President Obama and his seemingly rapidly evolving, if one can say that, strategy on contending with this new sort of threat du jour, the so-called Islamic State, also known as ISIS and ISIL and the Caliphate. Where do you think we are and where is he headed?
Well, I think President Obama has learned into his sixth year trying to create a legacy of ending the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan that just like you don't get the war you want, you don't get the presidency you want. And the unforeseen has come to pull him back to a very difficult decision about the direction the country is going to go to protect itself. And it was one he was hoping not to have, which is why you saw him squirming for weeks about what we were actually going to do about the threat from ISIL, which is what he calls it, which is interesting because he actually gives it the more broad and more expansive name, the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant. But he is finally coming around to the truth, which is this is not to be dismissed, that it's not something that's containable, that it has to be dismantled. I think that you still see caveats where the president tries to say, and his advisors, it'll take years, it might not happen under our watch. They don't want to take responsibility for finishing off ISIL. They don't know that they can. But they finally are agreeing that this is an unprecedented threat.
Yeah, it is an unprecedented threat, they think, and they say now that they will destroy it. We're visiting with A.B. Stoddard of The Hill. She is its associate editor and one of its eminent columnists. You will find her work at a number of other outlets, including notably Fox News, and we're delighted to have her with us talking about the president's program on this so-called Islamic State. And A.B., he is supposed to meet with congressional leaders tomorrow and then make an address to the nation Wednesday night. Do you anticipate that he is going to find ready partners for a concerted effort to actually destroy this organization when he talks with congressional leaders on both sides of the aisle? And if so, that there will be a new authorization for the use of military force coming out of this? And how would that be defined, do you think?
Well, that is the question, is whether or not they need to come up with new authority for the president beyond what has been the existing authority for the use of military force that's existed now since 2001 and 2003. The president has made clear in an interview with NBC yesterday that this is not a new Iraq war. This is not the conventional operation that we're used to because it doesn't work anymore. So how that authority is defined is going to be very interesting. I would like to say that I'm heartened by the fact that there's been a bipartisan, vigorous response about the need to destroy ISIS from both sides of the aisle in Congress. I don't know that they're in the majority. I think that there are a lot of people trying to run for the exits and go home to campaign and don't want to have a national debate where they take a vote on any use of any force or any authority for the president. And so this is going to be interesting to see what kind of materializes between the two parties and between the White House and the Congress in terms of Congress's willingness to be a willing partner. I think that they will probably hope that the existing authority from many years ago will extend to these operations or that they can define it that way. But I think it would be better for the country if there was a vigorous debate and a new authority delineating exactly what we're doing and what we have to do.
Yeah. And do you agree with me, A.B., that that has to be defined rather broadly? Because if we focus narrowly on this Islamic State outfit, as we formerly focused narrowly on al-Qaeda, that we're going to continue to find ourselves buffeted by and perhaps very profoundly threatened by new manifestations of what is really fundamentally a sort of global jihadist enterprise with a common, despite differences among them on certain points of theology, basically a common ideology they call Sharia.
That's right. It's really, I think, fruitless for us at this point to start to provide the president authority, a specific authority, where he's going to go after this one group, because it will be a new group. It's a game of whack-a-mole. They continue to churn up in different manifestations, as you said, in different places, under different names. But this is now with technology and social media, it's not, we can't turn the clock back. It's burgeoning and really exploding, and it's not something we can control on a group-by-group basis. So we can argue over the different tactics, but we can't argue over the definition of the problem. It's ongoing. It'll be with us for maybe generations, maybe forever, but it's something that is not a temporary problem that we can destroy in a couple of years.
And let me just ask you, Abby, you're a close student of what happens in the political world in Washington, and you just described the ambition of most members of Congress, I guess, on both sides of the aisle, to get out of here, preferably without taking any hard votes. One of the things I've been struck by, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this, is the absence of a really formidable, loyal opposition to the president on so many of these policy missteps and poor judgments and fiascos, for that matter, on national security. What's up with that?
Well, it's interesting. We really saw, I think, in 2012, Mitt Romney flip and flop on a withdrawal for Afghanistan. The party itself in the primary did not have a real debate over the fact that we had moved away from occupying wars against counterinsurgency more towards counterterrorism, that we're running these kind of covert wars in Somalia and Yemen and other places. This is largely ignored by the Republican Party. Why? Because it's changing and its leaders are responding to the war weariness of the public, but really heading towards a more isolationist strain that has not existed in the party before, that is really confusing the party right now. I would argue that the third leg of the Republican Party, the third leg of the stool, the sort of defense, strong defense leg, is just sort of wobbling off and rolling down the hallway. So at this point, we've seen an interesting switch, you know, a big, strong reaction among some of them. People who are contenders for the White House would call themselves leaders. Senator Cruz, Governor Perry, and others say we have to take out ISIL, and the president has been weak and slow in his response. But as we see them move through the 2014 election onto a real effort by our government to combat ISIS and towards the 2016 presidential cycle, I'm going to be interested to watch which Republicans are separating themselves from each other and how, who really is a hawk. Are John McCain and Lindsey Graham, both senators, are the last remaining hawks who will get up and argue for a vigorous response and a long, sustained response and a long, intense commitment on the part of Americans leading the coalition? Or is it going to be something else? They're not making themselves clear at all. There's a lot of talk, but not a lot of specifics.
We need clarity, that's for sure, and with your help, we'll get it. We have less than a minute, AB. Very quickly, what did you make of the president's kicking the can down the road on amnesty?
Well, I mean, I think that he was under tremendous pressure, and it was realistic political pressure that the cost of taking executive action in this midterm cycle for the vulnerable Senate Democrats was going to be higher than any kind of galvanizing Latino vote that might have maybe helped only in the Colorado race. So it was clear that it was going to be a huge mistake. The president was going to make it anyway. But I think the president is actually going to do something in the lame duck session and try to put pressure on Congress to vote on something then, or he might take executive action again.
Watch this space is all we can say, and we'll be watching it closely at the Hill, as I know will you. A.B. Stoddard, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us about these things. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon.
Yes, happy to. Thank you, Frank.
We'll talk with you in the near future. Next up, we'll have a conversation with Congressman Mark Meadows. He represents, with great distinction, the people of the 11th District of North Carolina. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Barack Obama says he'll postpone granting amnesty to millions of illegal aliens until after the American people vote for the Congress that will have to cope with the consequences of this reckless decision. The president claims he doesn't want to politicize the issue, but the principal reasons for this executive amnesty are entirely political. To circumvent the constitutional lawmaking process and put countless alien unregistered Democrats on the path to citizenship and the vote. It seems Mr. Obama and his party's endangered red state senators think Americans who currently have the vote are too stupid to understand that something they don't like is coming in 2 months. My guess is that they will vote for candidates who will oppose Obama's amnesty and the magnet it would constitute for millions more illegal invaders. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
I'm very pleased to say we're back, joined by Congressman Mark Meadows. He represents with great distinction the people of the 11th District of North Carolina. He is a member of several committees of considerable interest to us, including the House Foreign Affairs Committee, on whose Middle East and North Africa and Global Health subcommittees he serves, topics that we'll be talking about with him in this segment. Congressman, welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Frank, it's great to be back with you and look forward to discussing some of the issues that are very important to your listeners.
Well, we are as well, and thank you for returning from recess to take on some of these issues. And maybe we could start with the one that colleagues of yours will be meeting with the president to discuss. We've been discussing it here with Abeet Stoddard most recently, namely the threat, as you see it, from the vantage point of your subcommittee assignment, posed by this latest, well, I think of it as kind of an outcropping of the global jihad, namely the Islamic State. Do you regard this as the sort of threat that military force and other instruments of our power should be brought to bear upon directly and swiftly?
Well, certainly we have to do that, Frank. You know, we can't continue to just put our heads in the sand and not address it. That seems to be the foreign policy of this administration, is just ignore it, hope it goes away. And what's happened with ISIS in particular is they were only about 1,500 strong just a few months ago. Now they're up to some 20 to 30,000 strong, depending on who you're talking about. But the other problematic thing is that Al-Qaeda and a number of affiliates across countries are lining up behind this effort. So it is part of what you said, a global jihadist movement, and it has to be dealt with firmly and with great resolve, and we must do that now before that battle comes back on U.S. soil.
Yeah, and of course, we're marking the 13th anniversary of 9/11 this week, and I'm just struck by the fact that so few people in Congress or out, for that matter, appreciate what you just said, that this really is a much bigger challenge than just this particular group. And I guess in that regard, I would ask, Congressman, A.B. Stoddard wasn't making book on whether there would be action by your colleagues on a new authorization for the use of military force in the little bit of time that you have in the next couple of weeks in town. Do you anticipate that Congress will, in fact, respond if the president asks for it, presumably Wednesday night, that he'll get a go-ahead? And if so, how do you think that language ought to be shaped? Should it be broadly defined or very narrowly focused on the immediate challenge of ISIS?
Well, ISIS may be the genesis of this particular effort only because we've seen the beheading of a couple of journalists, and so that brought it home for everybody. But that kind of thing is happening all across Northern Africa, the Middle East, and in other parts of the world. And so to suggest that this is just isolated to the ISIS threat would be wrong. So it needs to be broader. I don't see the president asking. I mean, he is so opposed to having a real use of force that, you know, a little dabble do you is kind of where he tries to address that. And that will not work. We've got to be resolute. It is not only a threat to U.S. citizens. It's a threat to the Muslim world, the more moderate Muslim world. What we really have here is that there is a truly a committed jihadist get rid of all the enemy approach that is being waged, a war that's being waged, and we have to recognize it for such. I know a number of my colleagues, both certainly Republican and Democrat, will be ready to take action just because we see the threat is real to U.S. Citizens.
Yeah. I was just going over some language that your colleague, Congressman Frank Wolf, who's been a real leader on so much of this and sadly is going to be leaving the Congress at the end of this session, is apparently going to be putting forward, talks not only about authorizing the president to use force, all necessary and appropriate force, as he puts it. But he talks about the various, again, elements of this jihadist movement, and specifically makes the point that they share a common violent extremist ideology. They call it Sharia. That seems to me to be the way we ought to describe it. But do you think that that kind of overarching assessment of what's impelling these guys to wage jihad against us ought to be reflected in whatever authorization goes forward, so that we're not simply engaging in kind of a glorified whack-a-mole exercise that keeps this enemy going just in different quarters and different forms?
Well, Frank Wolf is a great patriot, a good friend of mine. I will say that there are some who are pushing back against that because what they're wanting to do is go after this particular thing, and they don't want to give too broad of a scope of this battle, but to ignore the fact, and I think that's where Frank is coming from, to ignore the fact that this is not just in Iraq, that it's happening throughout the Middle East and the world over and over again. is to really ignore what we know from an intelligence point of view, and we can't do that. So we have to take a broader approach. I don't know that there's the intestinal fortitude to do that, or we're all reluctant, and we don't want to play politics with our men and women in the armed services. I'm a strong supporter of them. And so you never want to play politics with potential loss of life. Yet at the same time, to not address it in a broader scope than just ISIS would be wrong.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I hope that, as you say, this will be something that reflects ultimately in the legislation the reality that you put so well. They're at war with us. You know, they declared war on us, so we ought to recognize it. Congressman, let me turn quickly to another area of your responsibilities. As I mentioned, you serve on the Foreign Affairs Committee's Subcommittee on Africa, Global Health, Global Human Rights, and International Organizations. And just about all of those are now consumed with the crisis arising from this, well, seeming pandemic of Ebola. The president has announced that he wants American military personnel to now go in and try to help contain this threat in West Africa and perhaps beyond. Give us your assessment of how grave a peril this represents, not just for the people of the regions that are most immediately affected, but perhaps for the wider world, including maybe here.
Well, it is a global issue. It's growing as the headlines grow and have continued to outline this each day. And so the health of a number of African countries are at risk right now. And because it is spreading, you know, we do have to make sure that we intervene. American military services doing that, I'm not sure that that's the best answer. Our healthcare providers know how to deal with this. A lot of the NGOs know how to deal with that. And so having people there to help with quarantine and making sure that it doesn't spread. But a lot of this is within the culture and the way that some of these African countries, their culture would suggest, would actually put them more in harm's way with the spread of this. And so I know Sierra Leone was the latest one to look at some of the issues there. We're having hearings tomorrow as well as throughout the week on this particular subject. And so I'm hopeful that we will start to see a real response, not just from the United States of America, but internationally, because my heart goes out to a number of these folks. Headlines for healthcare providers when they come back, but you know, thousands and thousands are dying, and potentially tens of thousands more could die.
Yeah, and that may well be on both sides of the pond, as they say. Congressman Mark Meadows, thank you very much. Your service to our country is deeply appreciated. I hope you'll come back to us after these hearings and talk further about what you think is the way ahead on contending with the crisis of Ebola and, for that matter, the crisis of the global jihad. In the meantime, thank you, sir, again for your service, and good luck in Washington in the remaining days of this pre-election period. And we'll be rooting for you, needless to say. Next up, we'll have a conversation with one of America's top Latin America hands about trouble in our front yard. It isn't just illegal aliens. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeinvisible.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events. To let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at DailyCaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Any Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Any Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined by Paul Bonicelli, He is a man with considerable background in the region that we touch on as frequently as possible here at Secure Freedom Radio, namely what I think of as our front yard, some call it our backyard, Latin America. Paul served as an assistant administrator in the U.S. Agency for International Development's Bureau of Latin America and the Caribbean. He was also a deputy assistant in that organization for democracy, conflict, and humanitarian assistance. He also served two terms as an official delegate to the United Nations General Assembly. Also was on the staff of the House then called International Relations Committee, now the Foreign Affairs Committee. A man of many parts and considerable expertise. Paul, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thanks, Frank. Good to be with you.
I am very concerned, Paul, as I'm sure you are, about developments in a strategically located and strategically significant nation, namely Venezuela. There have been some very tumultuous developments over the past few months there with demonstrations and murder of some of those demonstrating by the regime and Cuban thugs and others cracking down, and now some rather sweeping changes, it seems, in sort of the political firmament with several cabinet-level individuals replaced and very serious economic distress as well. Talk, if you would, a bit about what's going on in Venezuela at the moment, where you think it's likely to lead, and what it means for us and our interests in that region.
Sure. You know, we're seeing the very slow degrading and I think really the demolition of Venezuela. This has been going on a long time. It started with Chavez. You mentioned my time on the Hill. I remember talking to the State Department when I was working for the House Republicans, and I said, you know, guys, this guy coming to power, Chavez, is not a Democrat. He's not going to be any good for us. And I got this typical State Department reaction, which is, you know, we want to talk. We want to, you know, have good relations. We can shape and mold this relationship. And so, you know, here we are 20 years later, and it's a disaster. And Maduro is, you know, there's nothing worse, Frank, than an autocratic megalomaniac than a dumb one. And Maduro is just not smart, totally unprepared for the positions he's been in. And as president, he is totally incapable of overseeing a nation as important as Venezuela with, I believe, the largest oil reserves in the world. And he's grasping to hold on to power. He's done what every socialist regime does, which is destroy the economy and eventually lose even the supporters that put him there. And he's ripe for the picking, as you note, with some of our enemies around the world who would like to make great use of him.
Well, let's start with the one in the neighborhood who I understand had a lot to do with the selection of Nicolas Maduro as the successor to Hugo Chavez after he became mortally ill with cancer and then ultimately died, namely the Castro brothers and the Cuban regime. What role are they playing in this meltdown in Venezuela at the moment, Paul Bonicelli? And again, what does that portend for the future of this country and for American interests?
Yeah, I think they're playing a couple of roles. First of all is the Svengali. I mean, they're controlling in many ways what happens in that country, despite the fact that I think some of Maduro's deputies are uncomfortable with the role Cuba plays because it makes them less important. But that's the role Cuba's playing, Raul Castro. They're also playing the role of survivor. I mean, Venezuela's the lifeline to Cuba. The oil that they get for free and other amenities, they get a lot of Cuban doctors employed in Venezuela to keep their regime stalwarts happy. And so they're staying alive by Venezuela, and they're keeping Venezuela on this awful track by doing so.
Yeah. It's a kind of a mutual suicide pact, it seems, because of course their own regime is tottering, and should Maduro fall, it would seem to me it may be curtains for them, though. We've seen the Russians coming to the Cubans' aid recently, and maybe we could back the lens up a little bit. Paul Bonicelli, again, our guest is the executive vice president at Regent University with a great deal of experience in Latin America and the highest levels of the U.S. government. Talk a little bit about a statement that John Kerry made a while back, that the Monroe Doctrine is dead. Against the backdrop of what the Russians are doing in Cuba at the moment, they're back it seems, in a big way. What the Chinese and Iranians and Hamas and Hezbollah and other forces external to our hemisphere are now doing very much in it.
Absolutely. You know, the Monroe Doctrine is often misunderstood, and it was all about U.S. security interests. It was a very practical articulation of the position that any great power or even a medium power would have in the world, which is our region cannot be host to threats to us. It's just not acceptable. There's no nation that accepts that, at least any government that's elected democratically won't put up with it, and no dictator would put up with it. They're there to preserve their power as well. So the Monroe Doctrine makes perfect sense, and for John Kerry to repudiate it was just dumbfounding, and I think it really disappointed a lot of people, even in his own party. You know, you and I both know there are Democrats on the Hill shrinking in number every election, but they're still there who think of themselves in the mold of Scoop Jackson and Truman. They're serious about national security, and I think when you have an administration like Obama, he's watched, Putin has watched for years, and Iran and the rest of them, and they know they can move in. So Venezuela is now prey to the machinations of all of those groups, including ISIS and others like that. They know they have a friend there, not because you know, these folks love one another. It's because the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and they all have designs on breaking U.S. power in the world.
Paul Bonicelli is an old Scoop Jackson staffer myself. I long for the day when there was more evidence of this kind of hard-headedness and realism and commitment to peace through strength on the Democratic side of the aisle. One of those who has certainly been exhibiting it in the present context, at least in terms of Venezuela, has been the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, namely Bob Menendez. He has been trying to get some sanctions, relatively modest sanctions, but sanctions nonetheless imposed on the Venezuelan government for its human rights abuses and other predations, only to be blocked by another Democrat or two. Mary Landrieu comes to mind most especially, a senator who's up for re-election and evidently doesn't want anybody to fool with CITGO, which has a presence in her state. How much, in your estimation, should we be pressing forward with sanctions against this regime, ideally, in my estimation, to bring about regime change there?
Yeah, I think I would have supported them in the past. I had my own. I'm probably like you. I haven't bought CITGO gas in years because I don't like to buy anything from dictators. And they can make all the arguments they want about the separation of CITGO as an American entity from Venezuela, but the fact is it props up Maduro and before that Chavez. And so I think that now is the time. Bob Menendez, I'm a lifelong Republican, but Bob Menendez is one of my favorite Democrats. I think he has a really keen eye for national security and the interests of the U.S. And what he's calling for makes perfect sense now because you see the turmoil in this administration. We know that the whole cabinet resigned recently. Maduro knew that he had to shake up things. And Ramirez, who was running the oil company and was the chief economic advisor, was the only one of the Chavistas who was realizing now we really do have to make some changes. This can't last forever. And I think he probably thinks our president is an idiot, meaning Maduro. But you have Mary Landrieu and others who are going to think first and foremost about those economic interests. And I think they're missing the bigger picture of national security.
Yeah. And in so doing, they're putting it at risk, I'm afraid, and probably not actually advancing our economic interests either. Paul Bonicelli, so much more to talk about. I would hope to get into a little bit of a discussion with you about immigration, but we'll do that on another occasion soon, I hope. In the meantime, thank you for your past service to our country and that you're continuing to provide at a splendid academic institution, Regent University, where you serve as its executive vice president. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.